This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. Today we're talking about diabetes. So the 2019 National Health and Morbidity Survey, which was released earlier this year, overall did not have much good news in terms of the health of the Malaysian population. But one statistic stood out above the rest, and it was alarming in its significant increase. It showed that the overall prevalence of diabetes in Malaysia was 18.3%. That's up from 13.4% in 2015. So we want to find out what does this increased prevalence mean? And more importantly, what can we do to reduce the burden of diabetes on individuals living with it, as well as on the population as a whole? And to discuss that with me, I have with me Datuk Dr. Farida Ismail, consultant endocrinologist. How are you today, Dr. Farida?
I'm good, thank you, Shaik.
Dr. Farida, I think we need a refresher. It's easy to assume that everyone knows this, but in fact, it may not be the case. Can you explain to us what is diabetes and what causes it?
Right. Okay. First of all, thank you for inviting me, Shaik. Diabetes mellitus, basically, is a word from Greek. And diabetes itself means the passing of a lot of urine. Mm-hmm. And mellitus means something that tastes like honey. So if you put the two words together, diabetes mellitus basically means passing a lot of honey-tasting urine.
Ooh.
So it's actually describing the symptom of the disease itself. But actually what is happening in the body is we have an abnormal increase in the blood glucose level that leads to the passage of this excessive glucose in the urine.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of people say if you eat a lot of sugar, that will cause diabetes. Is that true?
Yes and no, because in order for you to develop diabetes, there you need two things. One, an environmental factor that contributes to the development of diabetes. And of course, you have to have a genetic predisposition to develop diabetes. So frequently, when I see my patients, one of the first thing that we would be asking them is there any family history of diabetes? And very often there is. So if you have a genetic predisposition to develop diabetes and you don't take good care of yourself, you have a tendency to develop it at an earlier age. So if you take good care of yourself, so even if you have a genetic predisposition to develop diabetes, you may be able to delay the onset of the diabetes. So if you eat, you know, like 1 kilogram of sugar every day, you're just going to hasten it happening to you.
But delay the progression, delay the manifestation,
onset.
The onset of diabetes, does that mean that if you have that family history, it's inevitable at some point? Or you have a higher risk.
It's a higher risk. It's difficult to say that, you know, 100% you're going to be having diabetes. But if both your parents have diabetes, you are at a much higher risk to develop it sometime in your life.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't mean that you should not take any preventative actions. Even more, you should be taking, you know, active actions to try and delay the onset or prevent it altogether.
Mm, okay, and that's what we will be talking about later on as well. But just coming back to this basic information about diabetes as well, you know, what are the, apart from this honey urine or the sweet urine, right, what are the other possible signs and symptoms that would indicate diabetes?
Okay, before I go on the symptoms of diabetes, perhaps I need to highlight the fact that there are two major types of diabetes, type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes. Majority of us in Malaysia has type 2 diabetes, which means that medications may be used to help treat the type 2 diabetes patients. However, type 1 diabetics do not do not produce any hormone insulin at all. So their treatment is mandatory. They need insulin.
Mm-hmm.
So about more than 90% of the population, I mean the diabetic population in our country, belongs to the type 2 diabetes.
Okay, yep. And the signs
and symptoms.
Yeah,
the signs and symptoms, of course, just like the Malay word, kencing manis.
Yes.
You pass out a lot of urine. So usually patient would realize that if they don't get up at night to pass urine, they're getting up at night frequently to pass urine.
Mm-hmm.
And these are a huge amount of urine that they are passing. And as a result of that, they feel thirsty. So they crave for actually sweetened drinks because their body cannot use up the glucose that is circulating in the blood. So they crave for more and more sugary drinks usually. So this results in higher sugar levels and it becomes a vicious circle.
Yeah.
Cycle. So that's one of the very frequent symptoms. And many patients who came to see me actually came to see me because they realize sometimes after passing urine, if they don't flush it very well, they notice that there will be ants, circling around the toilet. So they realize, I mean, obviously because they're passing such sweet urine. Mm-hmm. In fact, 100 years ago, that's how we doctors diagnosed diabetes, by tasting the patient's urine because it tastes very sweet.
That's a big sacrifice.
Thankfully, we don't need to do that anymore. So you also tend to feel very tired because obviously, you know, glucose is an energy for the body. And because your cells cannot uptake it, that means you cannot use the energy, you're just wasting your energy. So you absorb the glucose and it just get thrown away into the urine. And you also will notice some weight loss in some patients. And sometimes you get blurry vision. Because this high glucose disrupts the lens in our eyes. Mm-hmm. So you may find it difficult for you to focus near when you're reading. And some patients may feel numbness on their hands and their feet. Right. So these are the major symptoms that you would notice if you're having a diabetes. But as we're going to discuss later on, many patients do not have any symptoms at all. Mm. Okay, so we have many cases where they are just accidentally diagnosed because they went for a medical checkup for university, for example, or even for employment medical checkup, and they suddenly realize that, they've got diabetes.
Mm. I mean, I presume that the increase in the glucose in the blood, it's on a spectrum. I'm sure it doesn't one day spike to an abnormal level. Does it follow a sort of progression?
Yes, definitely. So before you develop the full-blown type 2 diabetes, so today we're just going to be focusing on type 2 diabetes, because most of the population in Malaysia has type 2 diabetes. So before you develop type 2 diabetes, there is, for many years, you may be normal and then you progress to pre-diabetic status. And then from pre-diabetic status, you go on to become full-blown diabetes. When you are in this so-called pre-diabetic stage, your sugar or your glucose level is slightly elevated, but not high enough to be in the diabetic range, but not low enough to be in the normal range. Okay. So this pre-diabetic range it can vary from a few years to many years, depending on how aggressive you address it. So pre-diabetic stage is still reversible. Mm-hmm. With some luck and with some hard work, you can still go back and reverse and make the person go back into a normal state. But once you're diabetic, you cannot reverse it. You are permanently diabetic. So along the way, if you're pre-diabetic, if you just do not exercise, you eat an unhealthy diet, your body just cannot cope with the stress anymore. So your body cannot keep on increasing its insulin production. So at the end of this so-called pre-diabetic stage, you move on and become a full-blown diabetic. Mm. When you become full-blown diabetic, 50% of your pancreas is not functioning anymore. Mm-hmm. It means it's not capable of producing insulin anymore. So you only have 50% capacity of your pancreas left to function.
And it can no longer be reversed at that point.
Yes, correct.
All right.
It can be treated, but you cannot reverse it back to normal.
Right. As opposed to the pre-diabetic stage where you could, because the pancreas function is still better.
Yes. Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
But assuming, and I assume in the pre-diabetic stage, you don't have perhaps as distinctive of those symptoms that you described earlier, perhaps no symptoms at all?
Yes, no symptoms at all.
So how would somebody know that they're even in this stage? only, and be able to do something about it.
Yeah. So if you have strong family history, for example, or if you are overweight or obese, and for example, in some cases, patients are taking steroids for other reason, steroids medication, all this predispose you to develop diabetes. Mm. You should be alert to at least do an annual blood test, for example.
Yep.
To, or in some cases, patients who develop gestational type gestational diabetes, that means they are diabetic only when they're pregnant. So after they have delivered the baby, they should be on the alert and, you know, do at least an annual check to make sure that they have not developed diabetes.
Mm, because they are also at risk of developing the type 2 diabetes.
Correct, yes.
Okay, all right. We will go for a quick break now. And when we come back, we will look at that statistic that I quoted earlier from the 2019 National Health and Morbidity Survey. Our prevalence of diabetes is at 18.3% according to this most recent national survey. So what does that mean for the burden of diabetes in Malaysia? In the studio with me, Dato' Dr. Farid Ismail, consultant endocrinologist, and we're going to go into what can we do to reverse pre-diabetes, like you mentioned, Dr. Farida, and also manage, if you have full-blown type 2 diabetes, manage your condition because there are lots of complications to be aware about. All that coming up after the break on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. On the show with me today is Dato' Dr. Farida Ismail, consultant endocrinologist, and we are discussing the burden of diabetes and what can we do to either reverse it, prevent it, or at least manage it for those with full-blown type 2 diabetes. As Dr. Farida explained earlier in the show, 90% of those with diabetes in Malaysia have the type 2 diabetes, and this is a condition where you have abnormally high levels of blood glucose in your body, and there are lots of different factors that contribute to this, but family history is a very, very strong factor, as well as environmental factors such as your weight. If you're overweight or obese, your exercise and eating habits, as well as if you're on steroids, medication for other conditions. And these are all things that you need to be aware of so that you can monitor your blood glucose levels. Dr. Farida, can we very quickly look at how diabetes is increasing in our country? Mm-hmm. In the 2019 National Health and Morbidity Survey, it was found that the prevalence of diabetes increased up to 18.3%. The last survey in 2015 found 13.4%. What does this statistic actually translate into?
Mm-hmm. Before I go into the prevalence of type 2 diabetes in our country, let me just explain what prevalence means. Prevalence just means that how many percentage of the population are having the illness now, currently. Okay, so if you look at way back in 1960s, just a few years after we had our independence, the prevalence of type 2 diabetes was at 0.63%. Mm-hmm. So that's about maybe 60 years ago. So in 2015, it was at 15%, and the latest, which is in 2019, has gone up to 18.3%. This translates to about 1 in 5 of our population affected with type 2 diabetes currently. And even worse, in 2025, the projected prevalence is going to be at 30%. So it's going to be like 1 in 3. So we have to take some very proactive action to try and prevent this prevalence increase. And what is even worrying from out of this 18.3% of our population who's affected with type 2 diabetes, that translates to about 3.9 million of our population with diabetes. And from the survey, we discovered that about 1.9 million know that they have diabetes, but the other 1.8 million do not know that they have diabetes. So that's why we as doctors, sometimes, you know, we accidentally check the patient for something else. For example, they may be getting themselves admitted for dengue or something to the hospital, and then suddenly, the blood sugar is very high, because there are almost, 45% of our population who already has diabetes do not know and do not realize that they have diabetes.
And what are the dangers of that? What are the dangers of not knowing that you have diabetes? It's okay. Not just a static disease that stays like that.
Yes. The problem is, it's not just about your sugar. When you do not know that you have diabetes, so you won't be able to treat yourself. You won't be able to, sort of be conscious about the food that you are eating and so on. So your diabetes becomes more and more uncontrolled. And the problem with diabetes, it causes many complications. So the main thing is a cardiovascular disease complication, which means that people who have diabetes are more prone, 2 to 3 times more prone to develop heart attacks. Mm-hmm. And diabetics are more prone to get a more severe type of heart attacks when they get a heart attack. Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is not cardiovascular disease. It's not just heart attacks. It also include stroke. Okay. So they have an impaired circulation to their brain. The second major complication is the kidney damage that patients develop, either, because they know, even if they know they have diabetes, but if it's not well controlled, or if they do not know that they have diabetes. We've had many patients at the time of presentation already, for example, they've presented with a heart attack, and then, we discovered, oh dear, they have diabetes,
they
didn't realize.
They have jumped a few steps.
Yes, so actually, they actually presented already with complication. Mm. And patients with kidney failure, for example, or kidney impairment, at the time of presentation, they have already developed this complication. So we do know that about 50% of patients who presented with heart attacks are diabetics, and 65% of patients who has end-stage renal disease mm-hmm. who are on dialysis are diabetics, actually. So a major proportion of it actually belong to the diabetic population. Of course, there are other complications, like it can damage your eyes, causing what we call diabetic retinopathy, causing cataracts. And of course, it can damage your nerves. When it damages your nerves, sometimes we think that, it's probably nothing very serious. It just causes numbness. But the problem when it causes numbness is you get lots of infection without you realizing it. People who has numbness on your feet, for example. I just give you a very good example. I had one patient who is a chef, and he normally cooks in very big Malay weddings. Mm-hmm. So as you know, when they cook in big Malay weddings, they usually use the wood fire for the cooking the rice.
Yes.
So as he was stirring the pots of rendang and the pots of nasi biryani, he didn't realize that the end of his toes was touching with all the amber. Because he couldn't feel it. So at the end of the preparation, he realized that all the toes were scalded.
Oh,
so these are simple things that we think, that it may not end with a grievous complication. But as a result of this, you may get infection. And again, the problem with people who has diabetes, their circulation is not good. And they don't recover from infections as good or as quick as other people who are not diabetic. So this infection can lead on to gangrene, mm-hmm. and gangrene can lead on to amputation, because that's the only way to save the patient.
Mm.
So you know from the complications what the impact can be to a patient's life, because if you can't see very well, you cannot work. Mm-hmm. If you have stroke, you lost your job. If you have a heart attack, everything is compromised. If you have an amputation of the leg, for example, your lifeline is also affected.
That's right.
So this is not just about your sugar. It's also about, managing all the other and trying to prevent these complications from affecting the patient's life.
What proportion of patients with diabetes would you say, perhaps just maybe you can give a sense anecdotally from your practice, what proportion of them come in at the stage of the complications?
That's a bit difficult because it depends, on your clinic setup.
Mm.
Because for us, we work in the hospital. So sometimes maybe perhaps 5 to 10% of my patients, at the time of presentation, they already have at least a degree of complication. But they do not even know that they have diabetes. So just getting back to the prevalence of type 2 diabetes, another thing that worries us is the age group of a population, because we are seeing younger and younger people with type 2 diabetes now. Maybe 30 years ago, when, you know, earlier on during my practice, perhaps I only see people who are 40 and above. Mm-hmm. Majority of my patients are, you know, 60 and above. But nowadays, we are seeing, you know, like 18-year-old, 20-year-old, 25-year-old, and the prevalence did show that we are seeing a younger generation afflicted with type 2 diabetes. And what's even worrying is the younger generation are the ones that do not aware or are not aware that they have diabetes. Mm. Because for some reason, they don't develop the symptoms as much. Maybe, you know, younger body, they tolerate it that much well, or maybe they just cope with it. They feel thirsty, they just drink more water, you know. They don't translate it to, oh, maybe I have diabetes. Mm. So that's what's worrying us, because if you are affected with diabetes from the age of 18, you're going to live until the age of 50. So sometimes even after 5 or 10 years of diabetes, if it's not well controlled, you can develop the complications already. Mm. So if at the age of 18 and you are not controlling your diabetes, we are going to see patients coming in with heart attacks and end-stage renal disease, for example, you know, in late 20s, early 30s.
In the prime.
Which is, yes, which is something that, you know, we hope, you know, it's not going to happen. Mm. But that is what our main concern is.
Why are the patients getting younger? I mean, do we have a whole generation of these lifestyle problems?
Mm-hmm. Okay, 18.3% the prevalence of type 2 diabetes in our country. That's the highest in Southeast Asia. But when you look at the obesity prevalence, mm-hmm. Again, the National Health and Morbidity Survey in 2019, our generation is getting more and more obese, unfortunately. So about 40 to 45% of our population currently is either overweight or obese. Mm. So this definitely contribute. And I know that, I think we all know that we are seeing, you know, many obese children as well now. Because I think our lifestyle, you know, from 30 years ago has changed drastically. Children don't go out to, you know, run around. It's not safe to do that anymore, you know. Most of us prefer our children to stay at home. So we don't, you know, like go cycling. They don't go cycling on their own. Whereas when I was, you know, much younger, nobody cares. You know, I can just go out as long as I come home by my grip time, you know, mm-hmm. that's fine.
Yeah.
But we were running, we were playing, and kids now, you know, they do other kind of games altogether,
mm-hmm.
Mainly computer games, you know, so they don't go out, and we don't push them to go out. And the other thing is we have changed our eating habits completely. When I was, again, you know, many, many years ago when I was much younger, I don't get exposed to all the carbonated drinks.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we only get it, you know, at Chinese New Year or Hari Raya. That's when we really sort of drink bottles and bottles. That's it. Yeah. We look forward to this occasion.
Bottles and bottles are good.
Yeah. So, but, you know, that's when you really cherish it.
Yes.
But nowadays, you know, everyone, you know, you can buy all this readily.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes school canteens also sell them. So it's very difficult to control.
The environment is enabling these kinds of poor lifestyle practices.
Yep. So basically two things. One, the way we are eating is different. So, and the amount of time that we spend exercising has drastically reduced. And these two things contribute to the development of obesity, and that, you know, lead on to type 2 diabetes.
Yeah. And then you have a generation where the prevalence is increasing, and that is going to affect their future generations because of their increased family history.
Yes. Yeah. And obviously, obese children will become obese adults. Mm. So if we need to take action, we need to take, you know, we need to start early.
Mm.
We have to teach our children how to eat healthy early. We need to, you know, get them moving.
So let's look at what can we do. And this sort of, I'd like to look at it in two different areas. What can we do to prevent diabetes, whether in somebody who has no sign of increased glucose levels at all, or perhaps slightly elevated in the pre-diabetic stage? What can we do to prevent it from becoming full-blown diabetes? Mm-hmm. And also then, mm-hmm. what can we do when you are diagnosed with diabetes? What is the goal of managing it there?
Yeah, it's exactly the same as managing someone who's diabetic, basically. So if I ask you what would be a healthy lifestyle to you, you know, it means you exercise regularly, you eat properly. That means you cut down your sugar, you cut down a little bit of your carbohydrate, cut down your fat, take lots and lots of fresh vegetable. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of food that, you know, a diet, a healthy diet, a balanced diet, reduce processed food as much as you can. And of course, reduce all the sugary drinks. And this includes, you know, all the canned, carbonated drinks, even alcohol, and stop smoking altogether. So that's the diet part. And the exercise part, of course, try and be as active as possible. I think exercise should really be like a part of our life. It's like you get up in the morning, first thing you do is you remember to brush your teeth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, exercise should be like something like that. You know, you remember, oh my God, I haven't, you know, done my 10,000 steps, or I haven't, you know, gone running or cycling or something, you know, today. So it should be like a part of your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. The recommended exercise time would be about 45 minutes, at least three to four times a week. Okay. So it doesn't matter what time you do it, in the morning, the evening, or, you know, whenever you have the time. So you should slot that as part of your lifestyle, because if you don't take good care of yourself, you know, nobody else is going to do that for you. And our body is very precious to us. It's the only one that we have.
Mm.
And of course, if you're overweight or if you're obese, try your best to at least lose 10% of your weight. You don't need to achieve a normal BMI. You can only go for 10% reduction in whatever your current weight is, because that 10% weight loss has been shown, between 5 to 10% of weight loss has been shown to be giving you definite medical benefit. So from the point of view, reducing your risk to develop diabetes, hypertension, and high cholesterol.
And sustaining it, of
course.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
You know, but I'm sure there are people who are going to say, you know, all this is very difficult to do, doctor. Why can't you just give me a pill?
It's, there are two groups of patients. There are, you know, patients who do not want to be on medications, but there are patients who prefers to be on medication. The way we decide whether we are still talking about pre-diabetic, because in pre-diabetic status, there are some patients who we would give medication, but their dosage and the type of the choices of medication will be different from people who are full-blown diabetic. So, for example, if you know that this person, say, for example, just giving you an example, a 40-year-old gentleman, for example, who's had a heart attack, and he's a pre-diabetic. So we would treat that patient perhaps with a medication, because we want to normalize his sugar, his glucose level to as normal as possible, because we know that if he is diabetic, he is at a higher risk to get a second, third, fourth heart attack. So even though he's in the pre-diabetic range, he would be a very suitable candidate, you know, that you would start on medication. Mm-hmm. So not everyone is suitable for a medication, but definitely certain group of patients would be suitable.
Right. And is medication absolutely necessary then in those with full-blown diabetes?
Yes and no. It depends on the stage that they present to you with. I've seen many very health-conscious patients who, when they develop diabetes, their sugars are not that high. I mean, we diagnose diabetes when the sugar is 7 and above, the fasting glucose. So some patients present with 7.2, 7.3, for example, you know. And some patients present with 30, for example, the blood glucose level. So It depends on the patients that you're seeing. Mm-hmm. And if the patient, for example, is already dieting, is already exercising, and yet the sugars are still high, so we have no choice. We have to start them on medication. Mm-hmm. But if, for example, the patient's sugar is 7.5 and the patient tells you, oh, I haven't started exercising, you know, I haven't attempted any diet restriction, mm-hmm. I'm drinking 3 teh tarik every day. Of course, that can be, we can wait first, let the patient adjust their diet accordingly, and then reevaluate whether the patient needs medications or not.
Can you walk us through how medications help to manage diabetes?
Okay, so before I tell you about medications and how it can help with the management of diabetes, I'll just tell you why we developed diabetes in the first place. So basically, when people with type 2 diabetes, they are producing insulin. Remember I told you, you know, at the time of diagnosis, there's only 50% of the pancreas is working. Insulin is needed because insulin opens the glucose gates in the cells. So when after you've eaten, your glucose gets absorbed, so it goes through the blood circulation, and then in order for the glucose to enter the cells, it has to open like what we call the glucose gates. So insulin holds the key. So it's like insulin opens the gates so that the glucose can enter the cells, and then the glucose can be used as energy. When you have type 2 diabetes, you do not produce enough insulin, and your cells have some resistance to the insulin that is being produced. So if you imagine, the key is like rusty, you know, so you try, the insulin arrives at the cell, tries to open the gate, but it's not opening. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a part that we call a situation where a condition where you have insulin resistance. So your body is producing insulin, and but you know, the body is just not responding to it. So in the long run, you develop type 2 diabetes. Your sugar, your glucose becomes higher and higher. So medication,
because it can't enter the cells.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. So medication works in various ways, mainly by trying to make the pancreas increase further the production, and by reducing the insulin resistance that the cells have towards the insulin. Mm-hmm. So that's how medications work. Nowadays, because the more we learn about diabetes, we know that the development of type 2 diabetes is not just because of the problem with the insulin alone. We know that in our intestine, the intestine produces this so-called incretin hormones, or more specifically called the GLP-1 hormone.
Okay.
So what this GLP-1 hormone does is it also helps it goes to the pancreas and push the pancreas to produce more insulin at the presence of glucose. When the glucose is high, the gut or our intestine produces this GLP-1 hormone, and it helps the pancreas to produce more insulin. At the same time, it also helps to reduce the gastric emptying so that you do not overeat. You know, you feel full earlier in that sense. So this incretin hormones, or GLP-1, play a major role in helping to control the glucose, not just insulin alone. And what we have discovered over the last 20 years or so is that type 2 diabetic patients do not have or do not produce enough GLP-1 hormone. So not only do they not producing enough insulin, but their GLP-1 response also affected.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why majority of type 2 diabetics are also overweight, because the brain appetite center do not receive the satiety. You know, you don't feel that, oh, I'm full already, I need to stop eating. Mm-hmm. That response is also delayed. So they have a tendency perhaps to maybe overeat, and then it makes it difficult for them to lose weight. Mm. So these are the perhaps the modes of treatment that we can actually utilize to help control the patient's diabetes.
So are there advancements in treatment that target these pathways?
Yes. So in type 2 diabetes, obviously you can use medications. So medications can be oral or in the form of injections. So injections now, we have two types of injections. One is obviously insulin injection, but normally type 2 diabetics, they do not need insulin from the word go. As I mentioned earlier, type 1 diabetes, they need insulin from the word go. So type 2 diabetes, maybe at the end when, you know, sometimes the medications do not work, we may need, because the body just not producing insulin anymore, so we need to add in insulin. In the beginning, medications can be used. And as I said earlier, there are now the so-called GLP-1 receptor agonists in injectable form. So they are not insulin, but they are injections that increases the GLP-1 production in the body. Mm-hmm. So they are what we call GLP-1 receptor agonists. And we have moved from having GLP-1 receptor agonist injections twice a day to once a day to nowadays once a week, which is very convenient for the patients. And the advantage of using GLP-1 receptor agonist injections is the fact that it not only controls your sugar, helps to balance your sugar, controls your sugar, it controls your sugar to the extent of normalizing it, but it doesn't bring it down to less than normal. So it stops working when you reach a normal sugar level. So from that point of view, you do not experience what we call a hypoglycemia in this kind of treatment, because a hypoglycemia means, you know, low sugar. And when you have low sugar, it becomes very uncomfortable for the patient. They get tremors, they get cold sweats, and so on. So these are the side effects of medication that we try to prevent the patients from having. So GLP-1 receptor agonist has the advantage of not causing hypoglycemia in patients. But at the same time, because it helps to reduce the gastric emptying and it increases the satiety center in the brain, it helps patients to lose weight. Mm. Which is something that, you know, you want your patient, your diabetic patient to do, or because majority of our type 2 diabetics are overweight. Mm. So if we can have a treatment that can control their sugar without making it going too low, but at the same time, making it able for them to lose weight, it would be an ideal treatment.
Is it suitable for all patients?
Type 2 diabetes? Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Most patients, unless your patient is very, very thin, usually, you know, we don't use it for very thin patients.
Okay.
But for patients who are slightly obese or overweight, definitely, you know, it would be suitable.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit, Dr. Farida, about, you know, whether patients, you know, with all these advances in medications and with all the advice being given to them to modify their lifestyles, do patients still struggle to control their blood glucose? And what are the challenges that they face?
Okay. When I diagnose a patient, I newly diagnose a patient with type 2 diabetes, one of the first thing that I would tell them is you need to accept this. That's the first thing. You have to take charge and you have to take responsibility. Okay. And you have to be motivated to control the illness. So acceptance is difficult. Sometimes patient takes a week or two, you know, because they feel embarrassed. They feel maybe like a failure. You know, I've tried my best, but yet, you know, I still develop high sugar. So I would tell them, you know, it's happened. So there's no reason to feel upset about it. You know, the sooner you accept it is better. Yeah. And you start taking charge of it.
Mm-hmm.
By taking charge, that means you know what this disease means, what the complications are, and what do I need to do. Okay, so that's the first thing that I would tell a patient. And many of my patients, they live alone. You know, they are single, they live alone, so there's no family support or no one to actually cushion them from this. So the sooner you accept it, the sooner you take charge, the better for you.
Mm-hmm.
But if the person has got a family, so we normally would speak to the spouse as well. Or if it's a younger patient, we speak to the parents, for example. And we look at the environment. So if usually, if one family member has got diabetes, we would advise, you know, the whole family to eat like a diabetic. You know, after all, it's a healthy diet. Yeah. You know, it's a healthy lifestyle anyway.
It's good for everyone.
It's good for everyone. And if one family member has diabetes, the other family members are at risk to develop diabetes anyway. Mm. So it's good. In some ways, you're supporting the diabetic person, but at the same time, it's good for you as well.
Yeah.
It's good for you to exercise. It's good for you to have a healthy diet. It's good for you to lose weight. So this help, you know, definitely with the management of diabetes in that particular person.
Mm.
So it's easier said than done. Yes, I agree, but it's not impossible. I have many patients who, you know, sugars are perfectly good, even though they're diabetic, and they live a good, healthy lifestyle.
Mm, yeah. Is there some level of apathy that sets in after years of being on treatment and medication?
Yes, of course. Because sometimes patients' control is so good that they become careless.
Okay. Victim of their own success. Yeah.
So I've lost patients for 1 or 2 years. You know, they... good control, and then they just go along, and then they forgot about medications and on, and then they came back 2 years later with either still good or you know, not good sugars.
Right.
So yes, yes and no. So that's why we as a professional, we need to continue to motivate our patients. And one of the things that I find is good to have if they could check their own sugars at home.
Mm.
There are many glucometer devices that patients can check their own sugars, and they can monitor their own sugars. And when you see a good sugar reading, you feel good yourself, you know, and you feel... I can control my sugars.
Mm.
So that helps to motivate the patient. So having a glucometer, having a good family support helps. But even if you don't have any of those, doesn't mean that, you know, you can't control your diabetes.
Mm. You know, do you have a final message that you'd like to share with us today, Dr. Farida, especially on preventing and managing diabetes?
Okay. I think with the scary statistics that we're having at the moment, you know, 18.3, 1 in 5 of our population are affected with type 2 diabetes. So I think one of the best thing that you could do for yourself is, whether you're diabetic or whether you're not diabetic, is just drink sugar-free. That's the first thing that, you know, everyone should be doing. Try and not add any sugary stuff into your drinks. Even we do not encourage artificial sweeteners.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So eat well, which means that have a balanced diet, plenty of vegetable, cut down on your carbohydrate, and make sure that you exercise regularly. Try and maintain a good, a normal body weight. If you cannot, try and lose 5 or to 10%. You don't have to wait until you have diabetes, or you don't have to wait until you're pre-diabetic. You need to prevent it, and you need to start now.
Mm, yes, and going for regular checkups, and that's how you can keep track
of
whether your glucose is in the normal range, and being able to take action early.
Yes, of course.
Thank you so much, Dr. Farida. I've been speaking to Dr. Farida Ismail, consultant endocrinologist, about preventing and managing diabetes. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.